What I would like to do today is chat to you for a few moments about one approach in leadership. There's so much that one can possibly say about leading, about the relationship between leaders and followers, about constructing organizations. But as I spent some time in prayer and really asking the Lord, what would be the best and the most profitable to share with you this morning, I'm going to speak to you for a few moments about some practical steps towards a kind of leadership that can transform our world. And so I've entitled this, The Quest for Transformational Leadership. As you know, I teach at Regent, and our mission statement is the reason why I went to Regent. Initially, when I was confronted with this mission statement, it's a very simple one. And the mission statement very simply says, Christian leadership to change the world. I did not go to Regent because I understood it. I went to Regent because I had a whole host of questions. And I remember sitting down with the vice president for academic affairs when I was just hired. And I think they kind of looked at me at the end of that and said, I don't know if we did the right thing here. Because I sat down and I said, all right, so I have a lot of questions. Firstly, what do you mean, what is leadership? What do you think leadership is? My biggest problem was that whatever I saw about leadership in the bookshops and within the books did not match Scripture. The second, maybe the bigger question is, what is Christian leadership? One of my biggest concerns have always been that when I walk through Christian bookshops and pick up books on Christian leadership, it's very often not original material. It's stuff that people have stolen somewhere, they paint a fish on the cover, Scripture in the beginning, Scripture at the back, and now it's Christian. And this is often what we do. And then maybe the larger question, if Christian leadership is supposed to change the world, big question, who is the world? Where are they? What do they look like? And what do we want to change? And so when I was hired at Regent, those are the four questions that I came with. And I said to our VP, and I said, all right, so quickly answer for me these four questions. What's leadership? What's Christian leadership? Who's the world? And what do you want to change? And he kind of just looked at me and said, check in with me later. And so what I would like to do this morning is chat to you specifically about this kind of leadership that can change the world. Several years ago, Kofi Annan, who used to be the General Secretary of the United Nations, gave a speech here in Africa, South Africa in actual fact. And initially, I kind of looked at the speech and I thought, that's a really stupid thing to say. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, no, hang on a moment, he might be right. And he stood up and he said, the greatest problem in Africa, greatest challenge, is not one of poverty. The greatest challenge in Africa is not one of poverty and it's not one of disease. He said the greatest problem is a lack of leadership. Today I stand here and I agree. I think this holds true. And so what I'm going to do today, and I'll quickly take you through the kind of structure of what I would like to do, is chat to you about several things. Very different to yesterday. Today, I want to step forward a little bit more as a professor and share with you some theory, some models, some approaches. And at the end, I'm going to link it within the church world, if that is okay. Even if it isn't okay, I'm still going to do it, but I'm going to be polite about it and ask as well. I want to start off by chatting to you for a few moments about a need for a new model of leadership. The study of leadership, of course, academically is a very new study. It's about 70 years old. And the difficulty about leadership is that it has, as an academic study, not a redemptive origin. I'm always amazed at the academic conferences that I speak at, and 50% of my speaking engagements are secular audiences, which is always a problem, because I do not have the gift to speak to secular people. I just throw in Jesus every moment, and I always get into trouble for that. But it's amazing to me at international leadership conferences how nobody wants to speak about the white elephant in the middle of the room. And what is that white elephant? Let me tell you what it is. That leadership studies as a discipline has a terrible beginning. What was the origin of leadership studies? By the way, initially out of psychology, and then moved into kind of the industrial psychology and then business models a little bit later on, a little bit in sociology as well. But the origin of leadership studies was very simply this. How do we put a whole bunch of people in factories with very little space, make them work very long hours under terrible conditions, pay them absolutely nothing, and motivate them and make them think they are happy? That's the origin of leadership studies. It's the study of the rats in the maze without telling them that they are rats. Now, in the last 20 or 30 years, people have steadily tried to redeem the discipline. But at the root of leadership studies is the sin of manipulation. When our students come to our school to study, and I'm sometimes the wrong person to put right at the beginning. Because my job very often, I feel, is to encourage people to leave as quickly as possible. And one of the first things that I will say to students is, all right, so why do you want to be a leader? And one of the things that I love about American students is that they tend to be very forthright and honest. And so I asked this question this year during our residency. And one of my students, CEO of a company, stood up and he said, "That's a stupid question." I said, "Sure." I said, "Well, what do you think? Why are you here? Why do you want to become a doctor of leadership?" And he said to me, "It's obvious. I am studying leadership because it's better to be a leader than a follower." Think about it for a moment. He said, "When you are the leader, you decide who keep their who will keep their jobs. You're the one that gets the corner office. Your salary is substantially better than the follower's salary. Who doesn't want to be a leader?" And again, it's rooted in that system of manipulation and self-serving ambition. And so I felt when God called me to the formal study of organizational leadership and to work as an academic within this field, that I literally stepped into an unredeemed area. So for a few moments this morning, I want to speak to you about how we need a different model, a different approach. Now, the interesting thing is it took me a few years to realize that what was prevalent within organizational leadership studies is prevalent within the church. The church, we still have the 1940s great man theory. God has a plan, He sends a man, and our job is to support the man. Can there be anything different? So for a few moments, I'm going to chat to you about a new model, and then I want to spend some time defining leadership. The difficulty of working in this field is that leadership has not been defined yet. There are still large arguments amongst the scholars whether it is an actual discipline. I think of myself as a missionary amongst these people, consistently. But I do want to offer some practical definitions of leadership, and then I'll tell you why I don't like them and what I think is missing. Even within Christian authors on leadership, I think our definition stinks. The most prevalent definition amongst Christians on leadership is simply this: leadership equals influence. No, don't say that word. No. Uncle John, I am sharing a platform with him next month, so I need to behave myself as I am now. I'm the kind of warm-up speaker for him. And I did not know this. I was booked. I didn't plan this. This is a massive problem. It's in Beijing next month. So do pray, and I need to redeem myself and take back all the ugly things that I've said before I get there. But this is a problem. Actual fact, well, now that you've offered it. A while back, John was on campus, and I want to tell you, I have the greatest respect for John Maxwell. He's an incredible guy. He's a stand-up person. He's a man of great integrity. See how I'm redeeming, preparing the path? Yeah. Even though all of that is true. But I said to him, I was invited. There was a small meeting, and an email went out from our president's office saying that he would like to meet with five key people. I tell you what, I sent that email so quickly, and I said, I have to be there. And so I've read everything that John has written, and I said, John, so first question, I said, I hate your definition. I am not saying that that leadership does not include influence. I said, but here's the problem. Where's the issue of holiness and morality? According to your definition, Hitler would be a fantastic leader. Alexander the Great, Herod the Mad. And we can go down the list. Well, I don't want to speak so close to home. Yes, I'm trying not to get into trouble here. But think about it. Leadership must be more than just simply influence. I've been asked by CBN, Christian Broadcasting Network. I'm starting to do some work for them, and so I have a weekly blog that's going on their website and starting to write some things. And one of the things that they said to me, they said, well, we want you to write on leadership, but come up with a real, you cannot believe that Christians would say this, they say, come up with a sexy title. This is not the CBN. Seriously, yes, I had to write back and say, I don't think that's really appropriate, but nonetheless. And so I thought, what would I call a leadership blog? And I decided to call it Leadership Beyond Influence. It's a little Maxwellian kind of a little hidden knife there, and I will redeem myself and I will pray. But we need a new definition. Leadership can simply not be about influence. Because if it is only about influence, we are playing the fame game. We're nothing else but Hollywood stars. Leadership includes influence, but it needs to be much more than that. There needs to be a moral center. We're going to chat about that for a few moments. And then I want to go back to some of the newest developments, and not just that new. This comes from the 80s and the 90s, but this is the best that we have right now. On defining what transformational leadership could look like. And this is a leadership style or leadership approach, according to theorists, that tries to include this moral center, the center of what is the right thing to do. And also a leadership that says it's not about me, but it's about my follower. It took me a long time to recognize that as a leader and as a scholar, my success can never be measured in what I do. It took me a long time to recognize this. So any accolades, any awards, any of those things are actually pretty useless. How can I truly measure my success? I can only measure it by what my students will do. For the little time that I had with them, one day, the only way that I'll be able to say, was I a successful teacher? What did my students accomplish? There has to be a different focus. And then I want to speak to you for a few moments. And again, forgive me, I tend to over-prepare. So I when I looked at it earlier this morning, and I thought, there might just be too much information here. But one of the things that I say to Mona as well, these slides are yours. You can do with them whatever you want to. I developed them for here. You can use them. I don't have any copyright or any of that. But I'm going to speak to you about building transformational organizations, not just transformational leaders, but organizations that will facilitate change in people's lives and change within the fabric of society. Speak to you about constructing compelling visions. And then typical to who I am, of course, I do want to offer an ancient example. And what is the example here? It's Christ. How did Jesus do this? So kicking off, let's start with the need for a new model. I think we've increasingly realized that something is wrong within our world. This generation is faced with probably the greatest challenge of any generation that's ever lived. It's not that our problems are larger. That's not the reason. The reason why we are faced with the greatest challenge of any generation ever before on the face of the earth is that we know. We have access to knowledge. Before, the only thing that we were responsible for was our immediate surroundings, because we were aware of it. And we really couldn't go anywhere else. And so as a church, most of our concerns would be, how do I deal with my flock, and how do I deal with my town? That's all changed now. We live right now in a global world. And I don't know if you truly understand this, but the world is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and our responsibilities are growing and growing and growing. Because not only do we know what is wrong in the world, we have opportunities to change it. I wish that when I was in my early 20s, that somebody would have sat me down and told me this. I'm like a cat. I don't travel well at all. I don't like to go places. I just want to be at the same place. My son is exactly the same as I am. We are homebodies. I just want to stay. If I had a cave, I would be in the cave all the time. The difficulty is that I get to travel the world every month, pretty much. I'm in a different country for a few days. And I'm consistently kind of feeling out of sorts and asking the Lord, well, how in the world can I make a change and a difference here? And the Lord says, you know, you have a responsibility and you have a role to play. Think of all the changes that have occurred in just 20 years of the internet. On a daily basis, this morning before I came here, I already had email conversations with somebody in Russia, somebody in Moscow, somebody in Taiwan, somebody in Europe, and somebody in Canada. That's just in the first 15 minutes of my day. And there's an opportunity to impact those people. Increasingly, it is impossible to just be a local citizen. And as churches, we are going to have an incredibly important role to play globally. And so I think we're starting to realize that we share this common goal of reconstructing societies ravaged by racial discrimination. I don't know how many of you recognize that the issue of racial discrimination is not over. I think we deeply recognize that. One of the biggest shocks for me in moving to America is how prevalent it is. The issues of racism in America is substantially larger than here. Very difficult to realize. Not only is that true in this place in the world, in America, but it's also true in other places such as China. We started to realize there's issues of disease prevalence, economic injustice, collapse, corruption, crime, and most importantly, leadership failure. Slowly but surely, we've started to realize that something is wrong. And our approach to how we're going to do this is not working. I have not been in America long enough to make any sense of their political system. It is incredibly entertaining to watch. It's like the Bold and Beautiful. It is very vibrant. It is incredibly active. And everybody is highly politicized. And so I am asked all the time, are you a Republican? Are you a Democrat? Are you an independent? And I easily step out of that and say, no, I am an ignorant. I don't understand your system. And so therefore, I am not going to say anything about it. But what is interesting is that the leadership models that have been offered by American leaders are no longer working in the rest of the world. And one of the fascinating things for me in America is that somehow the American leaders are not recognizing that their place in the world has changed. They are no longer the leaders. And yet they stand up and say, we are the world powers. You hear this rhetoric all the time. We are leading the world. No longer. It's an incredible shock. Let me tell you who is leading the world right now. Economically, within less than 5 to 10 years, China will lead the world. The amount of money they are putting into development in the midst of this recession. I don't know if you know this. There are places in China that had 25% economic growth. Shanghai now is a city that's already 15 to 20 times larger than New York City. And more build up and more luxurious with more money. It's already the world capital. And what is interesting to me is that the leaders in America are simply not paying attention. And they still think that we can employ that old model, that great man theory model of telling people that in the whole world, we are keeping you in your factories, we are giving you bad light and bad working experiences, and we're going to manipulate you and tell you and try to tell you and keep you happy without telling you the truth. The problem is that China has woken up. They will have none of it. There are talks that very quickly the Chinese currency will replace the dollar. Everybody's still teaching everybody, every single child English. It's not going to be very long where the major language in the world will be Chinese. And let me just stop for a moment. I don't know if you are paying attention to what's happening in Africa. 200,000. Have you looked at the statistics in Angola and Mozambique? I had a meeting with the Chinese. I was at a banquet, small banquet, 15 people, with the Chinese Minister for Religious Affairs. Do you know what word he used when he spoke about Africa? And I thought, I can't believe he just said that. Colonization. There are places in Africa, Angola and Mozambique, that there are reports coming out now saying that China already owns more than 20% of the land. They are buying up all the mineral rights. They are buying up farms. They're buying up land consistently. And the interesting thing is what we are still doing when it comes to leadership is that we're still having that rhetoric thinking that we're in charge when we are not. Many people have said to me, why is your focus now in the East? Because that's the future for Africa. My biggest desire right now is the church in China, that the church in China that will rise up will not make the same mistakes as the church in the West. I consulted with two Vatican officials in Prague last year and spent a day with them. And I made the cardinal mistake of saying, if you were smart, you would move the Vatican to Beijing. That's what the early church did. The early church went to Rome because it was the heart of the beast, not because it was hospitable to Christianity. They said, Rome is going to be the future of the known world at the time, and that's where we're going to go. But what do we do as Christians? We remain in places of great comfort. Because our leadership models is still about ourselves. It's not about transformation. Jean Lippmann Blumen, who is an incredible author and scholar, she resides in Richmond, very close to where we live, about an hour and a half away. And years ago wrote this and got into so much trouble in the leadership community for this statement. It almost got her thrown out. And she writes, we finally began to re-examine more critically our traditional concept of leadership. It is based on an outmoded ego ideal. That leadership is about affirming our ego. It's about me. Wherever I travel in the world, people always ask me, all right, So your leadership studies, what do you teach? It is so difficult to explain. So I finally came up with this. Do you get the apprentice down here, that program? It's a stupid program of Mr. Trump. And he's, of course, an easy target right there. I had a student take that program and aesthetically analyze it as a project. Just aesthetically. Have you ever watched a program and see what happens? What's the opening sequence? Do you remember the music? Anybody remember? Money, money, money. You remember that's a song right at the beginning? And then you get certain phrases that are on the screen. It says, it's not personal, it is only business. So two things Mr. Trump is telling us about leadership. It's about money. It's never personal. It's only business. And then what's the climax of the show? Have you ever looked at his body language? You're fired. Get out. What do leaders do? It's about money. It's never personal. It's about business. They fire people and they send them out. That's what it's about. And I always tell people, have you watched The Apprentice? They say, yes. I say, we teach the opposite. It's incredibly helpful. It's a helpful program because I watch it. I watch it religiously so that we make sure this is not what we do. And John continues on. She says, it is based on an outmoded ego ideal glorifying the competitive. And I want to stop for a moment. Competition is a waste of energy and time. It's not scriptural. It never is. Do not for a moment think that God competes with Satan. Satan competes with God, the other way around. It is based on the competitive, combative, controlling, creative in a negative sense, aggressive, self-reliant individualist. And so increasingly we've realized that whatever model we have of leadership and leaders, this is not working. And so what's interesting is that China is changing their model. So we as at Regent were asked by the Association of the Chinese Association for International Friendly Contact. They came to visit us. It's a bizarre name. They came to visit us a while back. They had a meeting with Hillary Clinton and us. And so I'm at the banquet here. This is in Washington, D.C., and we're sitting there. And so I'm so confused. Firstly, I realize these guys are not who they say they are. And so we hired a cultural attaché, a Chinese student, to help us with translation. And because, you know, we're just idiots when it comes to the culture. We don't know what to do. We make every practical mistake. I bow when I shouldn't bow. And I drink tea in the wrong place. And don't know how to handle the chopsticks correctly. And all kinds of wrong things. And she trains us. And so I said, quickly ask them. There's several questions that I had. Well, firstly, we found out that the Association for Friendly Contact is a front organization for the Chinese military. So now I'm very curious, why in the world, now this is an important question, why in the world would they choose Regent? This makes absolutely no sense. Yale, yes. Harvard, yes. Stanford, yes. Princeton, yes. Cornell, yes. Not Regent. So I asked the question, why Regent? They wouldn't give me an answer. So I am so puzzled. And then out of these meetings and lectures and things that we got an invitation this year to go. They flew us over, put us in the best hotels that I've ever been in, beyond 5-star, with drivers and suites that we stayed in. Actual fact, the one room that I stayed in is bigger than my whole house. And we are so confused. I'm just confused. I don't know what's going on. And they treat us so well and make us speak at the communist universities, spoke probably at 14 universities in about 7 or 8 days, and have meetings with ministers and all kinds of things. And I'm confused. I don't understand what's going on. Of course, I'm not going to say no to this. What an opportunity. But I'm confused. And so finally, we're in the city of Xi'an, and I'm walking with the major official that we're working with, Mr. Zhao. And I said, Mr. Zhao, and he can speak English. I said, now that everybody's gone, I have to, I have to ask, what's going on? Why would you choose us? Why do you have us here? I have the wrong qualifications. I am the wrong speaker. You know that I'm a minister. You obviously have done your homework. You know who I am. You know who the other people are. You know who Regent is. You're not bad. Why in the world would you have us? Listen to what they said. He opened his coat jacket and took out a tiny little Bible. And Mr. Zhao said, we have money, we have resources, we have power, but we don't have values. We don't have a book like this. Your job, he says, and I want you to come back, is to help us to find values. I looked at that and then I finally realized this guy's a Christian. And the Chinese government has realized that they have absolutely everything in their habit. They've got the money, they've got the workforce, they are incredibly smart people. The amount of universities that they've built, I visited 7 universities that have been built in the last year, and they're bigger than UNISA, the buildings. There are no students yet. They're just building. They've got the money. They look like little cities. We went to one university that they've built for 500,000 students, residential. It's ready. In the city of Lanzhou, which is a very poor area. They're ready. And they say, we've got absolutely everything, but we don't have values. And then he said, only Jesus can help us. This is what the guy said. This is a communist official. China is ready to make that change. America is not. Europe is not. The question is whether Africa will make that change. Leadership scholars realize that what we have is not working. We need something new. We need a new model. And that model must be able to transform. I think, by the way, it is providential that God has sent China to Africa. If I can encourage you, those are the people you should target for evangelism. They think they're coming for colonization. But I think the Lord is sending them to become Christians. I am not a prophet, and I'm not predicting. But if the Lord tarries, I can tell you in 50 years, the greatest amount of missionaries will come not from America, not from Europe, but from China. And so the question is, what will we do with this? What will we do with these incredible opportunities that we have? So there's a need for a new model. Scholars for years have said this, and they say there are 4 very important characteristics of this new model. It must be values-based. For a lack of a better phrase, morality, holiness, purity. Doing the right thing at the right time for the right reason to the right people. The second attribute is that it must be follower-focused. We live in a very interesting time. It is not a time that is very, very different to the 16th and 17th century with the invention of the printing press. People are being empowered. And worldwide, people will no longer follow a leader just because he or she is a leader. They now want to know. One of the ways that I see it is just in teaching at universities. And America is a little bit ahead of this when it comes to students. I don't know about you, but when I went to university, when I went to college, there was an incredible power distance between the professor and the student. In America right now, there's none of that. The student simply steps forward and think of me as a resource and will make use of me as a resource. They will send a paper to get a draft reviewed. If I do not answer within the hour, They'll send a note back. Where are you? What are you doing? Why are you not looking at this? I sent it an hour ago. What's going on? They're just ready. They do not want to be told what to do any longer. And even though that's a negative aspect, the reason why this is happening is that people are now saying, we will follow leaders that care for me. And whatever happens in our model, it must be follower focused, not leader focused. There are some radical leadership scholars who are now standing up and saying, there's no such a thing as a leader. We only have followers that step forward in moments to lead. It's an interesting concept. Thirdly, it must be strategic and able to adapt very quickly. Our world is changing so rapidly that it's almost impossible to keep up. I remember the first time that I encountered motivational theory is when people still taught all of us to have 5, 10, 15, and 20-year plans. Those things no longer work. Most of the scholars in strategic thinking do not speak about planning. In actual fact, we do not teach strategic planning at all. We teach strategic thinking. What's the difference? We speak about strategic intelligence. That we are able to adapt at a moment's notice. That what leaders do is that they keep their eyes open, looking at all the things that happen around them, and they're able to make changes as things change. Think about how our world has changed in 20 years. Do you remember the first computer you worked on? Do you remember those black screens with the green lettering? Some of you will not even remember that. It's before your time. But I remember those times, how difficult that was. It's difficult to remember time without email. It's difficult to remember time without texting. Do you remember those first cell phones that were like bricks? You could kill several donkeys with it. You know, it was just an incredible weapon. Now everybody's got a cell phone. What will happen when all of Africa is blanketed with internet-free access? There are now countries, I don't know if you know this, Denmark has put it in their constitution that it's a constitutional right to have access to internet. Just now, 3 weeks back. If our world has changed in 20 years, how much is it going to change in 10 years from now? I went to the World Futures Conference last year, delivered a paper there. And the World Futures Conference is where people around the world come together, scholars that only think about the future. And they show the greatest technology there. They've shown us some of the new thinking about computers. And the newest computers that's already done are this small. Literally, you clip it on the side of your belt. They have a glove, an invisible glove that you wear, see-through glove. And you have glasses with a computer screen in your glass that projects it. Or they now have contact lenses that you can put in and it projects an image of the computer screen in your vision. Wow. With voice technology. And the glove works in 3 or 4 positions in which you can type. And the idea is that they say very soon all of this will merge and you will have no longer a laptop. In the East, I have a laptop like this. You cannot get this any longer. The new laptops have come out very small because the laptops and cell phones are merging. There are places in the East where they are no longer selling televisions. All of the stuff is just merging together. And they say what will happen at some point is that you will have this computer and the next time you greet somebody, before you see him, you can Google him without them knowing. And you will get all that information that you need with picture and info. And they say this is 4 or 5 years away. There's already technology for the merging of certain hardware with our brains. It's already been done. And so whatever leadership model we have, we will have to adapt very, very quickly. To churches, this is of tremendous importance. Some of the churches that I work with in South Africa 20 years ago spent millions and millions and millions building buildings that would take 40 years to repay. And the church world has changed so radically that those buildings can no longer be used. They're not able to change it. Strategic. Able to adapt. Also, it must be able to transform organizations. And not only organizations, but the world around. So what I want to do this morning is chat to you about one possible solution in how we can do this. And this is the theory of transformational leadership. Another interesting thing that is happening is that the two key players in the world, Africa and China, are no longer ready to adopt Western models. I don't know if you know this, but in Africa, no longer will people say the solution for our problems will come from America. They are standing up and saying, if there is a solution to our problems, it must come from here. And interesting, what's happening is that Africans and Chinese people are looking backwards to their own history for possible solutions. Whether those solutions are helpful or not, that's the big question. In Africa, systems such as Ubuntu, and you know Ubuntu is a very difficult concept to define, and it's open to lots of manipulation, lots of problematic issues with it. In Chinese, there's this issue of huanzi. And huanzi literally means this issue of reciprocal relationship, hospitality. But it can very easily degenerate into a mafia system. Scratch my back, I scratch your back. And so the question is, what will we look? What will we find? What will we see? What will we do? So what do we need to do in the midst of all of these cultural values coming up again, old cultural values, is that we need to define leadership again. I'm going to use this definition. It's not the best definition, but it's the one that's holding up the best, the moment to scrutiny. Peter Northouse, who's a good friend of ours, writes several things about leadership, and this is what he defines it as. He says, leadership is a process whereby an individual influences a group of individuals to achieve a common goal. It's a very Western definition. There are several things that I hate about it, but it's the best that we have right now. And the first thing that you need to understand is that leadership is not a person. It's a process. One of the first things that I said to Dr. Winston when he asked me and recruited me to go to Regent, I said, if your school was called the School of Leaders, I wouldn't come. Leaders are very important, but I'm interested in the process. Let me just step back and speak a little bit about what I spoke about yesterday. You see, we need to understand that even though God has called us as leaders, that's never our identity. You know that in heaven there will be no pastors, no teachers, no apostles, no evangelists. Those functions will cease. And it's funny that we put all of our identity in those things, thinking it's going to take us beyond the grave. It's not about leaders, it's about leadership. It's a process in which one individual influences a group of other people to achieve not his or her goals, a common goal, a goal that God has called us to fulfill. And so this, I think, is the best definition that we can come up with. Now, Dr. Winston, who you know, has written another definition. I'm not using it. And let me tell you why. I love Winston. The reason why I don't use his definition is that it's exactly 26 pages long. I'm not joking. I'm not exaggerating. His definition is 26 pages long. It is ridiculous. It's called an integrative definition of leadership. I said, this is madness. We can't use this. It's true. It's very complex. This is the best definition that we have right now. We have to include some moral aspects. What I would like to do is offer one possible solution that might work here. In leadership studies, there are many different theories. There are roughly now about 45, 46 different approaches, theories. This is one theory that is holding up. And I will then compare it to what Scripture's got to say. And this is the theory of transformational leadership. It is an attempt to redeem this system, this field of leadership studies that had such a terrible, horrible beginning. And in transformational leadership, the leader enhances the motivation, morale, and performance of his follower group. It's a leadership style that has at heart the transformation of the follower, the organization, and the world. It's this issue of change. I have a different word for it. I think of this as conversion. Isn't this exactly what God does with us? This transformation that we go through, this conformation into His image. Now, just forgive me for a few moments. Before coffee comes, I will chat to you a little bit more about this and give you some history of the development of this model. Transformational leadership is a leadership style that is defined as a leadership that creates valuable and positive change in the followers. Have you heard of servant leadership? Robert Greenleaf? Greenleaf actually was deeply influenced by this. And Greenleaf really identified it in this way. He says, how do you measure the success of a leader? Look at his followers and ask this question. Are his or her followers better off at the end of their engagement with the leader than before? You know, it's a really simple thing. When I consult for churches, that's one of the first things that I do for pastors. I said, ask this question. After being a pastor for 5 years, look at everybody in your flock. Are they better? It's a good question. Do you know how often I encounter people that have been in the church for a year and they walk away and they say, I am not better. I am not healthier. I am more broken. I am more confused. I'm further away from God. I'm not a better father. I'm not a better husband. I'm not a better worker. I'm not a better leader. Transformational leadership is focused on this. The people that work for me, are they better off? It's a good question. I have found almost no leaders that ask that question. If you're the head of a farm, ask that question. That's transformational leadership. If somebody works for me after a year, are they in a better position? Economically, socially, spiritually, emotionally. It's a good question. In transformational, a transformational leader focuses on transforming others to help each other, to look out for each other, to be encouraging and harmonious, and to look out for the organization as a whole. Some people describe this as transforming people into first-class citizens. I have another word for it. Helping people to become human. Just human. Just good humans in the image of God, doing what God has called them to do. Now, forgive me for this. This is a little bit of background here. This is how this theory came out to be, and you will recognize some of these authors. The first person to write about this is James McGregor Burns, 1978. This is the first time that we have any writings on this. And he made the statement, and this is very important. He said there are at least two different approaches to this. And he said some leaders are transactional and some leaders are transformational. It's an incredible insight. Some leaders, it's about the transaction. So they say, if you do this for me, I will do this for you. It's merely a contract. This is one of the reasons why Americans suffer in China. Suffer in China. The Chinese do not work according to contracts at all. They don't even value contracts that much. It's about relationships. I struggle when I'm in China. I am not an incredibly great eater. These people can eat. I have never experienced, and I love Chinese food. But I cannot do 4 banquets a day. With 16 or 17 or 18 course meals. The food just comes and comes and comes. And there's no discussion on business initially. They are looking at you. They want to make sure that you are a good person to work with. In America, it's wonderful. Meals are no longer than 15 minutes. Go in, quickly eat. All right, what do you want? We can do this. Sign in the dotted line. Goodbye. That's it. Everything is about transactions. Not relationships. And Burns said, there should be a different way of doing things. How often in the church world do we fall back into transactional behavior? transactional. Can I say some things that's really going to upset you? Let me get into some of our theology. Isn't it interesting that as Protestants, we preach grace, which means the unmerited favor of God, correct? What did we have to do to earn His favor? Is there anything we had to do? Is there anything that we can do to earn our salvation? Peace. Heaven. Isn't it interesting, though, when it comes to finances, though? We somehow step away from grace. And we say, the only way that you can be blessed financially is if you give to me. It's the most bizarre thing. And I'm not saying I'm not against the principles of sowing and reaping. That is biblical. That stands. I am for the tithe. That is biblical. I'm for all of that. But it's fascinating how in some things we step immediately into transactional theology once again. Transformational leadership is a leadership style that goes together with the very grace of God. And Burns was exceptional in saying there is a difference between these two things. Bernard Bass, who was a kind of friend and rival, actually, with Burns, he decided to take this a little bit further. And he said transformational leadership is measured by the level not only of any kind of influence, but positive influence. Bass originally did not really have a moral center. Later on, Bass and Avolio then took it a little bit further. And they said, well, there needs to be some kind of the scripture of how do you take people that are deeply transactional and make them transformational, which I'm going to chat about today. And then lastly, Gary Yuckel came up and he said, well, the way that you do this is that you have to provide people with a different model. They have to see it. You have to help people see the big picture. What is the closest you can come to hell in an organization? It's not abuse. I think the closest you can come to hell in an organization is when you do meaningless work. How often do we have people do that? How often do we have people that just say, it's just a job? I am doing this one thing, this one little action in a factory, but I don't know what this means. I don't know why I'm doing this. Transformational leadership helps followers understand the impact of every small thing that they do in the larger whole. It provides meaning for them. I'm going to backtrack a little bit. If we taught this to prospective ministers, we would have much less moral failure. When leaders decide, for instance, to divorce their husbands or wives in a church, you know, I have some mafia in the family. I always feel, you know, I can sort these people out and just, we can solve this issue very quickly. But very often, I want to take these people and I want to shake them and say, did you consider the impact that you will have on generations of people? You are not understanding how the small action in your mind will affect. And transformational leadership is all about that, providing people with a vision, and not vision of an end product, but having your eyes open and understanding what is going on. Why do I do the things that I do? What is the role that I'm supposed to play? It's the only way that this can happen. So, what is transformational leadership? Yuckel, Bass, Avolio came up with four basic attributes of transformational leaders. And I'm going to spend time with each of these. I'm going to unpack it a little bit for you. Transformational leaders lead by what can be called charisma or idealized influence. I'm going to come back to this in a moment. And charisma here is not speaking about personality force. It simply means that transformational leaders lead by who they are, not through rehearsed behavior. That means they use their very being to transform. There are leaders that I've spent time with, and after I've spent time with them, I am a better person just by being in their presence. I observe how they deal with people. I'll come back to that in a moment. The second attribute is that they use inspirational motivation. You see, the quickest way to understand this is that it's the opposite of transactional motivation. Transactional motivation says, I'm going to motivate you by paying you more. Or I'm going to motivate you by paying you less. How often does it happen? It's true. The worst thing in the world is to work for money. It's an incredible punishment. At the heart of who we are, we want more. We know we've been created for more. So we cry out and we say, I want more. And inspirational motivation says there is a bigger role that you're supposed to play. You've been created for something larger, and I see it. I would not be here today if there were not people that looked at me and saw something that I could not see. I have people in my life like that. One of the things that you will see that I do is that when I teach and when I preach, I don't use notes. I don't know if you've noticed that. There's a reason for it. It's not that I don't have notes. I have detailed notes. But as an introvert, and I'll tell you a little story, I had a problem initially when I started preaching and ministering. I would have 14 pages, 20 pages of typed notes for every sermon. I still have those. I still do them. And so what would happen as an introvert, now other people can do it differently, this is just for me. When I would stand behind the pulpit, I would read those notes, and because I'm a textual person, I am present to the notes and not present to the people. And I would lose them. 2000, first time I met Dr. Winston. He heard me preach, he heard me minister, and he says, it's very good. And then he says, but you know, can I help you here? He says, you've got wonderful notes. He says, you should never ever preach or minister with notes. He said, as an introvert, you can only connect with one thing at a time. And so therefore, you have to preach from here, from what you know right here. You memorize it. You connect with it. And I said, thank you so much. This is wonderful. I'm not going to do it. And I thought, I'm not going to say that to him. There's no way. And I remember vividly, it was the Rhema celebration. And I'm one of the speakers. And we were both speaking that particular year. And I was speaking, and you were speaking right after me. And I had my notes, and we're sitting in the front row. And he's gentle, you know, and I don't know him well, but I thought, you know, there's no harm here. And he looked, he says, oh, those look really good. He says, can I have a look at them? And I gave it to him. And it's time to go up. And I said, give me my notes. He said, I said, give me the notes. He wouldn't give it to me. True story. And I finally, and he's a big man, and he looks kind of grumpy, and he's not. He's got that kind of grumpy look to him, and I got up. I had to do it from memory. And there was a significant change that occurred within me. He has seen something that I am unable to see. And he inspired me, and that motivated me to do a change. There are certain things that I'm unable to do. I don't know if you're anything like me. I do now quite a fair bit of television work for CBN. I cannot watch myself on television. I don't know if anybody's like that. There's nothing more painful. I cannot do it. I cannot listen to myself on an audio cassette, cannot watch anything on television. Just cannot do it. It is like watching those pictures from high school. I don't know if you've ever watched it. Painful. Painful, painful, painful. And you say, what were you thinking? But here's the point. Somebody at CBN heard me speak and said, with a bit of training, we can use you. And I thought this thing and I said, I don't want to do it. I'm not comfortable doing it. I hate it. I need an audience. I cannot speak to a camera. I'm just not comfortable with this. And this gentleman just pursued and pursued and pursued and pursued. And he said, no, we're going to do this. And I've seen something that I've not been able to see. And so transformational leaders not only lead by their being, but they lead through this term, motivational inspiration. They are able to show people something that they've never seen before and see a part of them that they've not seen and inspire them to do the right thing. It's not transactional. At Regent, we have 9 schools. Dr. Winston has tried some radical things in our school that could have gotten him fired many times over. One of the things that we do in our school, and I would not encourage any of you to try this, he decided a while back that none of us have office hours. Nobody. Except, of course, the people that need to be there, like a receptionist, somebody that answers the phone. Nobody else has got office hours. He made this decision. He says, I do not hire time. I hire hearts. So he would only hire people that are so committed to the organization and the vision that they don't need office hours. And so 2 years back, we had a new VP for Academic Affairs, and he got very nervous about this. He said, oh, all these people at GE, they don't have office hours. How do you know if they work? How do you know if the jobs get done? So Winston hired somebody, one of the GAs, to just follow us and actually clock the time that we work and send it to him. And he said, all right, so we can go back to 7 hours a day, 7.5 hours a day, and you can lose the 10 or 12 hours they actually work 6 days a week. Because they're inspired. They're inspired to work. With freedom.
Did you go back to the old system?
No. Well, we don't have office hours again. You know, we're back right there. For the other schools that cannot work, you need to have a very specific kind of leader. You need to do your hiring practices really, really well. You need to have people that just simply says, I'm going to do it. I get up very early in the morning. I have to get 3 hours or two hours of work done before my son wakes up. Because once he's awake, that's it. It is not physically possible to do much during that time because he wants to sit on my lap and he wants to talk and all kinds of really, really good things. And very often in the morning, I will go. And there's times that I have been there, and I'm not joking. There are times that I'm jet-lagged and I decide to go in at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I find people in the office. What are you doing? Well, I couldn't sleep, so I've decided to come and work. And you know, I'm going to finish all my work because then I can spend the rest of the day with my children. What an incredible freedom. Winston's job, one of the things that we don't win, in our school we do not have an academic dean. Our VPs go crazy. There's no reason for it. There are several positions that we don't need because we don't need people to find out if the jobs are being done. Vice President. Because simply people are so motivated to do the job. One of the things that will happen, and Winston will tell you this all the time, our jobs are done long before they need to get done. It's just done. People are motivated. And that's what transformational leaders do. The third thing that they do, they intellectually stimulate their followers. I told you before, I'm married to an Italian. My son is 99% Italian, and he is an incessant talker. He is a raging extrovert. It's his gift. He is never quiet. He wakes up talking. He falls asleep mid-sentence. I know the moment that he says, I am not tired. I don't want to sleep. Gone. You know, that's normally what happens. He's always been like that. But the problem with Jonathan is always that he's curious. We cannot watch... I struggle to watch television with him or a movie. And we have a movie date every week. Me and him have got one date every week, once a night. It's our night. We go out. We go for tea. We go for dinner. You like sushi. And then we watch a movie. And it's very difficult to watch a movie or television of him. And the reason for this is he's curious. Why is that man walking there? Where is his father? Where is his mother? Why is he alone in the movie? What's going to happen now? Everything is why? And sometimes I get so tired that I just say, Jonathan, don't ask why. Just do. I feel that's my only job that I do. It's time to get up. Why must I get up now? Why is it important to get up early? Why must I go to school? Why are there schools in the world? You know, why do I need to do this? Everything is why. But it's funny that I want to tell you, I make the mistake because what he's trying to do is trying to understand his place in the world. How often do we do this with organizations that we work in? There are many organizations that I know instinctively never to ask why. Just do. Transformational leaders are people that consistently say, you ask why. Another thing that we do in our organization, it's the most bizarre thing. Winston's business meetings. And this is, I want to tell you, in our school, I would not encourage you to do this. I don't know if it will work anywhere else. We don't have business meetings. Everything is done by email. But we have, every second week, we've got a large staff meeting. And at the staff meeting, he simply goes and sits in front. He says, all right, ask me anything you want to ask about rumors, changes. I'll tell you everything that I know. And I'll tell you what I don't know. And it's amazing, the freedom. And people say, you made that decision. Why did you make that decision? And he says, well, this is what I'm thinking. And maybe I'm wrong. What do you think? But I think this is the right thing that we're going to do. And I love it. Sometimes he is so honest, he will say, so I asked you to do this. The reason why I'm asking you to do it is because I like it. There's no other reason. There's no good reason behind it. I just like it. And I like it, and this is what I want to have done. This is the reason. There's an intellectual stimulation that happens. There's a lifting up. The last one, and then we're going to come back, and we probably will take a break there at this time, and then I'm going to go through each of these very carefully with you, is that it deals with individualized attention and consideration. Transformational leaders lead, not in large groups, but they lead simply by giving every person that individualized attention. Now, I'm going to say something radical, and then I'll explain it. Transformational leaders do not treat everybody the same. Paradoxically, if you treat everybody the same, you don't. Everybody's got unique needs. And transformational leaders are leaders that look at followers and they can see them. They say, you know what? This one needs something slightly different. And I'm going to make sure that I give to this person what he or she needs. When I started working for Regent, the first 6 months was the toughest. And let me tell you why it was very difficult. I couldn't deal with the caring. At some point, I walked up to Winston and said, stop it. I cannot take it. I don't know what to do with this. I can deal with dysfunction. Bring it on. But this kind of caring, I don't know what to do with this. And to this day, he still operates this way. I got an email this morning. He said, you know what? And he's got 18 faculty members to look after. He said, somehow on Facebook, somebody sent me your itinerary, and I see that you're very busy today. I'm going to take time out of my day, and I'm going to cover you in your dialogue sessions on Blackboard, online. This is my boss. He says, you should rest between this meeting and the following meeting. This is so typical of him. He has a leadership style called roaming. And he does this. Seriously. Now, you know Winston, he doesn't walk well. So you hear him kind of just breathing heavily, going through the office. And he does this every day. He walks around looking. He comes into your office and chats a little bit, looks around. He's not looking whether you're working. Not at all. He's looking at what do you need. And all the time this has happened. When I just started working, I was traveling to Chicago. I got a note in Chicago, and he says, I know you've got a neck injury. The chair that you sit on is incorrect for your neck injury. I have ordered another chair by Monday. That chair will be there. This will be better for your neck. A little bit later on, 6 months later, he said, you know what? He says, I don't know why I haven't seen this before. I said, I went past your office and I realized your computer is too low. You're looking down. This is going to cause pain in your neck. I have taken the liberty and I've raised your computer. This will be better. This is what you should do. He knows that I have certain weaknesses. He knows that my major weakness is books. This is an incredible temptation. This is my area of gluttony. It's an issue. When I go into a bookshop, I go into an existential crisis. All the books I haven't read. All the books I haven't read. I am stupid. All the books I haven't read. I need to purchase them all. I will spend every single little bit of money on books. He knows this, so he's helped me. There's a rule only in my office. Nobody else's office. He says, once you've read a book, if you don't look at that book or touch that book within 2 months, give it away. And he says, I will replace that book for you with a new one. He's done this. Mihai Bukania, you remember Mihai was once here? And a while back, his mother got really, really ill. And somehow Winston heard about it. And he knew Mihai's financial situation. And sent him a ticket for him and his wife to go to Romania from his own salary, his own private money. He's tried to do the same with me. It's just leading through individualized attention. And immediately you can see this approach to leadership is radically different. You lead by being. By inspirational motivation, not transactional motivation. Intellectual stimulation and individualized attention. We're going to take our coffee break right now, but when we come back, I'm going to go through each of these in great detail and give you some practical tips on how to do this in your organizations. All right, thank you.